This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The history of the AR-15 and why it's almost synonymous with mass shootings. From Marketplace in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for David Brancaccio. This morning, we continue our reporting on the nation's deadliest mass shooting in modern history. A gunman at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killed 51 people Sunday and injured at least as many more. According to law enforcement, 29-year-old Omar Mateen had both a handgun and a rifle known as an AR-15. It's a gun that has now been used in several mass shootings. Marketplace's Annie Baxter joins me with details. Annie, talk a little bit about the background of this style of weapon.
Well, the AR in AR-15 stands for Armalite Rifle, after the company that developed it in the 50s, originally for military use. Later, a civilian variant was designed. The AR-15 is capable of firing many rounds of ammunition in a short time, but most versions are semi-automatic, so you have to pull the trigger each time. It's the most popular style of rifle in the country. The AR-15 is used for a lot of different types of hunting, as well as for target shooting, and there are several manufacturers, including Aero Precision, Colt and Bravo Company.
And we've heard the name of this gun style many times in the past.
Yes, it's been used in several mass shootings, among them the attack last December in San Bernardino, California, which left 14 people dead. And an AR-15 rifle was used in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, where 20 first graders and 6 staffers were killed in December 2012.
And the AR-15 is also a flashpoint in the gun control debate.
Yes, it gets called an assault weapon, which gun rights advocates say is a politicized word. There's a lot of debate about what that phrase means, but generally people are talking about semi-automatic firearms with a large magazine. Some states restrict AR-15s, but in Florida you can purchase them legally. Now, families of kids at Sandy Hook did file a lawsuit against Remington, one of the makers of the AR-15, saying the weapon shouldn't be sold to civilians. But gun makers do have pretty wide protections from civil lawsuits tied to misuse of their products. That suit goes to trial in a couple years.
Marketplace's Annie Baxter, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now let's do a quick check of the markets. The FT100 in London is down 0.7%. The DAX in Germany is down 1.2%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down. About 1,000 economists are in Philadelphia this week for the Biennial Conference of the American Society of Health Economists. Over several days, they'll present hundreds of papers covering insurance, hospital mergers, and a host of other issues. Of all those, Obamacare will be the focus of 78 papers alone. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
We all know the Affordable Care Act's like a song some people love to hate. But as Republicans in Congress hold hearings to amend the law, there are signs of change. University of Illinois at Chicago's Tony Lasasso heads the conference. He says the research presented can help improve the law.
Incredible collected wisdom of hundreds and hundreds of scholars, learning about what we're getting for our money, learning about what works, what doesn't work.
For example, 19 states haven't expanded Medicaid, but research from people like Harvard's Ben Summers, who studies Medicaid expansion, shows up on the Hill and in statehouse debates. The impact of this work reminds Summers of art projects in his 5-year-old son's class.
They put their glue all over the page, and then they pour their glitter all over it, and then they pick it up and shake it off. And most of that glitter just falls right on the floor, but a little bit of it sticks. And I'd like to think our research is like that.
Summers knows a lot will go into making this law better, and a small part of it will come from the work a bunch of health policy geeks do this week. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This week on Marketplace, we're launching a week-long series called The Price of Profits. We'll be talking about corporations, What are they for? Who should they serve? And when companies say their only responsibility is to generate profits for shareholders, well, what about other people with a stake, like employees? From the Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Know anybody who works on contract, on demand? If you don't, you're living in a 1950s sitcom. Many companies have a two-tier workforce now, a blend of permanent employees and contractors, which sort of means what's old is new again.
If you went to the 19-teens, when U.S. corporations were just getting formed, there was a huge amount of outsourcing.
The Wharton School's Peter Capelli. He says business owners routinely farmed out different parts of the assembly process to individual contractors, some working outside their factories. They'd hire out marketing and distribution, too.
I mean, they were masters of kind of the core competency. It was mainly finance guys and a couple of people who had an idea, and they outsourced everything.
The mid-20th century, with careers for life and strong unions, was probably an anomaly. Scott Greer is 29. He's a freelance digital marketing consultant in Nashville. The old notion of lifetime employment sounds like death to him. And a company job? Been there, done that, he says.
You know, there's obviously some level of job security in a salary, but when you're in a certain position, it's like you kind of just see the future, not in a good way. It's just monotonous, and you just don't have as much control over, you know, what you want to do.
So far, Greer says he's been successful despite an initial flirtation with online sites where freelancers bid for jobs.
You're really commoditizing your work, and everyone wants to get something as cheap as they possibly can.
Greer's former colleague, Rich Pascal, has been in and out of the freelance world for decades. He knows the financial trade-offs, but he says in their business, the gap is narrowing.
You're seeing like a lot of prices coming down, salaries coming down, benefits being pulled back. So I don't know if there's any one safe place.
Pascal's advice to young contractors like Greer, get a good financial advisor. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And we'll continue our coverage of the price of profits all week on Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.